We've traveled to sunny California, and sooner or later you're going to hear the surf in the background, and that's the Pacific Ocean. We're visiting with Howard Duff. Howard, where exactly are we?
Well, let me see, Jack. We're about 15 minutes north of the Malibu Colony, the famous Malibu Colony. We're actually, this area around here is called Trancas. It's part of Malibu.
Trancas. I made a turn off of was that Pacific Coast Highway?
Pacific Coast Highway.
Trancas Market.
Yeah, about the Trancas Market. And you came up Broad Beach Road, and you're now on Sea Level Drive on the ocean.
And we're almost in a treehouse here, I think.
Yeah, it's a little little beach chalet.
It's beautiful.
Notice the oars up there. We call this the Oar House.
The Oar House? You have been here for how long now? On the beach.
Well, let's see. I've been a beach man for many years. I lived in the Malibu Colony for about 3 years, a long time ago. And then I rented houses out here, and we've been in this one now for about 2 years.
Mm-hmm. We'd like to go back.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it soon because I'm going out on a tour of the new play that Norman Coral just wrote.
What is the play?
I don't know whether he just wrote it, but I mean, we're gonna do it. It's a new play about Hamilton, Jefferson, and Burr, called Together Tonight. What is the title of it? Together Tonight, strangely enough. Mm-hmm. But it's about these three gentlemen, and John Anderson, a very fine actor, is playing the interlocutor. Monty Markham is playing Burr, and Dana Andrews is playing Jefferson. So I'm playing Hamilton.
Hamilton.
I'm playing Hamilton. Monty's.
When do you leave on this? When does it start?
Principal antagonist. We're going to start rehearsal. Let me see. I think the 15th of September, and I guess three weeks thereafter, we will be someplace opening, possibly my hometown of Seattle.
You expect to get to Broadway with this?
That's the idea. Yeah. Uh-huh. We're going to play in Washington, the big new theater there.
Is this a product of the bicentennial?
Well, I don't. Uh-huh. It isn't a product of it, but I'm sure that the idea was to capitalize on the bicentennial to a great degree. It'll be done in costume, kind of a town hall presentation, but it'll be done in costume, like they were addressing a contemporary audience, you know. And I think it's pretty kind of interesting. May have a chance.
We'll have to see it. I hope it gets to Chicago.
Oh, I'm not. It will. It's going to go all over the country.
Good. Yeah. Good. Let's go all over the career of Howard Duff for a little
all
while.
Over.
All over.
I don't know if you got enough time.
We've got lots of tape.
Okay.
Where did it start?
You mean as an actor?
As an actor.
Well, I started in drama school, I suppose. We called it oral expression, strangely enough, in high school. And I got interested, I kind of got hooked, and we had a very fine playhouse in Seattle called the Seattle Repertory Playhouse at that time. It isn't the same theater as the Seattle Repertory Theater now there. And I worked in the daytime on a rather menial job at a department store, and at night I was either rehearsing or playing a show. We did all kinds of things, Ibsen, Chekhov, Shakespeare, and Noel Coward, Odets. We wanted to do good things. I don't say that we always did them. Anyway, that's where I started.
You wanted to be an actor then?
I decided that I wanted to after I got involved in these things. And I finally got into radio as a radio announcer.
In Seattle?
In Seattle. Mm-hmm. And I did news, I did everything. And I finally gravitated down to San Francisco, where I picked up a couple of jobs down there as a newscaster and whatnot, and kind of an extra announcer at one of the stations up there. And then I latched onto a kid's serial called The Phantom Pilot, of all things. This is before World War II. Remember, you started this. We haven't even gotten to World War II yet. Anyway, I did this kid show for about two years, I suppose, and that went out. And then I did freelance work until World War II came along. I went in the Army, and I was in the Army for about 5 years. And I started out in the infantry, but eventually I got into, I'll skip a lot of the other stuff, I eventually got into the Armed Forces Radio Service, which is still, is now the Armed Forces Radio and Television Service,
right.
A branch of the Army.
Your
a branch
voice,
of the Army and Navy.
Your voice crops up on literally hundreds of Armed Forces Radio rebroadcasts as a collector of the old shows.
Oh, really?
I have a lot from Armed Forces.
Yeah.
And
I did a lot of the announcing on some of them.
Would you say this is the Armed Forces Radio Network? Maybe that, but there's, it's unmistakable. That's your voice there.
Yep.
Did you get involved in... well, what exactly were you doing with Special Service?
Actually, Elliot Lewis and myself were the started this department of... I can't remember what we used to call it, but what it consisted of, we... took all the best commercial shows off the air, and then we had to take all the commercials out and certain editing references, and then reassemble them. And,
you started this operation?
Elliot and I did, yeah. Elliot Lewis. And he was the head of the department, actually.
Well, how did that come about? I mean,
well, then,
whose idea was it to rebroadcast?
A civilian was doing it before, a fellow named Don Sharp, whom, strangely enough, I later became involved with in a show that I did with my wife, Ida Lupino, in 1958-59. But he'd started it himself, and then we took it over, Elliot and I, and then the department, of course, became enlarged, and... anyway, that's what I did, and then I went over to Saipan as a correspondent for the Armed Forces Radio Service. I was there when the war ended, and eventually got back here and out of the service and into Sam Spade.
Just that easy?
It wasn't that easy, no.
How did you get into Sam Spade? Were you doing freelance acting?
I was a freelance actor, and I'd worked with Bill Spear, who did Suspense, as you probably remember, and... they were auditioning for this new show. They thought kind of a Bogart type, and I guess I was the one that they thought sounded more like what they wanted. So
did you feel that you were a Bogart type?
No, I didn't. Eventually, I did what I wanted to, you know, my own stuff, and it got into a very pleasant 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, it was a long time running. Wild, did you get all the Wildwood cream oil you could
I could put on my head.
The show it plays so easy, so casually, and as I said, I have a number of the tapes, and you. It seems as though there was a heck of a lot of ad-libbing.
Yeah, I did a little.
Really easy.
I did a little. Well, we had a group of people that worked together often, and we were kind of a stock company. Lorene Tuttle played Effie, of course, and then she doubled as the old landlady and a lot of other characters. Mm-hmm. She's marvelous. And we had all the top people in the business, Johnny McIntyre, Jeanette Nolan, Ted Reed, to name a few.
Did this come out of
This came out of
Hollywood?
Hollywood, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The whole time.
Yeah.
Now you.
The Spade was set in San Francisco. Everybody used to think we were in San Francisco, but
like One Man's Family. They talked about that coming out of San Francisco.
But actually, it was here. Yeah.
Right. You.
At one time, One Man's Family did come from San Francisco.
The very beginning.
Yeah.
Of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You were introduced on the screen in the film Brute Force.
Yeah.
As Radio Sam
Radio
Spade.
Radio Sam Spade, yeah.
Right up in the credits.
That sort of annoyed me at the time because I just, you know, I didn't feel that should be, I thought they should just let me come on as Howard Duff and let it go with that. But as I look back on it, why knock it? What the heck?
That was
if it'll bring a few more people into the box office, great.
That was a good motion picture debut. Was that indeed the first time?
That's
you
the
appeared?
First time I was ever in the. Well, I did a training film for the Army, but that you can't count that. You know, I did played a soldier or something in the for Capra's unit, Frank Capra's unit, which is right next to us in the Armed Forces Radio Service in the old Fox lot.
But it was all out here then, wasn't it?
That was out here, the Armed Forces Radio Service, yeah. But then we had stations all over the world, and I ended up on Saipan when the war... did I say that before?
Yeah,
I can't remember.
Yeah, Saipan. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's where I was when the war stopped.
We're going to bounce around a little bit. When you were with Armed Forces Radio, did you have anything to do with the big variety shows that were produced primarily for Armed Forces?
No, that was another department. That was
some other area.
Most of those were done by fellows who had been producing shows, mm-hmm. The big variety shows at the time, Bob Welch, people like that, and the high price writers, Jack Benny's writers, Bill Morrow, and we had all the greatest talent, to draw from in the whole world,
By doing what you did, editing those shows and putting them on disc for play around the world, you actually contributed to the saving of thousands and thousands of radio shows.
I did?
Because you see, the networks never preserved the radio shows. I mean, they were all done live. Nobody bothered to record
them. All that acetate was destroyed.
Right, they went out. And AFRS put these things, you edited out the commercials, and you put them on the discs, and then the discs were shipped all over the world.
Sure.
Long after the war, long after radio really had kind of moved out of the picture as it was, as we knew it, in those 30s and 40s, some of these discs were found by GIs who grew up listening to those shows, and they made tapes of them and sent them back home. And if it wouldn't have been for... That's probably the best thing that ever came out of World War II, was the fact that those old radio shows
were first there. Yeah, I wasn't really aware of that. I was wondering where, somebody said, gee, I heard one of your old shows on the air. And I said, well, I don't know where anybody would get a hold of a recording, because I asked CBS at one time, if they had anything. No, they destroyed them all, because I don't even have one lousy acetate from all those years.
I'll send you a tape.
Thank you.
If you'd like.
I appreciate it. Somebody did send me a tape, excuse me, a little while ago, but isn't it strange that after all those shows I made, I have one acetate to show for it?
Well, there's lots of people who remember those, though. And so I just wanted to make a point about the discs that were
saved. Yeah, well, that is interesting.
That really made it.
Because the networks didn't have any interest in preserving them. So the Armed Forces Radio Service did.
Right. As TV came in on the scene, the networks were just, they needed space for all the bulky equipment. They would have a room with a lot of discs, maybe, to get rid of those things. We need that sort of business. And the military, who would ever authorize the destruction of discs? The army,
Don't destroy anything, right?
Destroy anything. Yeah. So they kept it. Well, all right. Let's bounce ahead to the Brute Force. You worked with a fantastic group of pros in that picture.
Yeah,
you held your own with it. You,
well,
you play a character by the name of Soldier.
I got by with it. Yeah, Soldier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They
were a pretty good bunch of guys. Yeah. Pretty. Yeah, Burt Lancaster was probably his, it wasn't his first starring picture. His first starring picture was Killers. Burt always started at the top, He never did anything supporting. And it was my first picture.
What happened after that first appearance, then?
Charlie Bickford was in it. Amazing. Hume Cronin was the heavy captain of the guard, or whatever it was. And Bud Bonin, Roman Bonin, was the warden, kind of weak warden. And let me see, Sam Levine was in it.
Mm-hmm.
It just goes on and on, a whole bunch of people. Anyway, it was a very good way to start. And
did that?
Yvonne DiCarlo was my girl.
Some of the girls in there were.
Ann Blythe, Ella Raines, you remember her, and somebody else who can't remember what. Whit Bissell was in it. You remember? Mm-hmm. You know who Whit is? Yeah. Anyway, it was a great way to start. Mark Hellinger was the producer, and he was a marvelous guy. And I was under contract actually to him. And the next picture I did was his ode to New York, Naked City, which was a pretty good picture. And then Mark died, and my contract went over to Universal, where I made a rather a series of rather undistinguished pictures.
It's the old Universal, huh?
Mm-hmm.
The late 40s Universal.
Yeah, the late 40s and early 50s.
They were trying to change their image from the real B, almost C movie image and the monster stuff from the early 30s to they wanted to upgrade, but it took a while for them to do it. Now they're
they only made about, at that time, they only made about maybe two or three, which I would consider important pictures a year. And the rest of them were more or less, let's put it in this, you know, they just didn't want to spend too much money on them, and they didn't.
You know. But all this time you had a good steady paycheck coming in from
that was it. Many times wondered whether I shouldn't have gone to MGM, where they really kind of built stars a little better than I think almost anybody else did.
Did you have a choice in that?
I had a choice. Uh-huh. I wanted to go with Hellinger. Yeah. Didn't know he was going to die. Right? No, he was a great guy. Very interesting man. He was a columnist, you know, columnist for years, and then he was a writer-producer at Warner's, and then he got his own company, and he's made a deal with Universal. And he's... Don Taylor was the guy who was also in Naked City. And it was his first big opportunity, I think, yeah.
Where did you make All My Sons?
At Universal.
That was Universal.
Yeah, I beg your pardon. Yeah. I did make a good... that was a pretty good picture.
Yeah?
Yeah. That was with Eddie Robinson and Burt Lancaster. And who was a great character actress? I can't remember.
I can't think of it now. That's what happens in these little sessions here. You start remembering and then you can't remember.
Yeah, then I have a little, a little block or something. But
Eventually... wrapped up the Sam Spade thing.
Yeah.
Probably near the end of the days.
That kind of went off, but it could have gone on and probably become a television show. But unfortunately, Dashiell Hammett went to jail for contempt of Congress during that. That was a big red routine going on. And actually, he had nothing to do with our show, but he created the character of Sam Spade. And so the sponsors just... And I made red channels because I was a little too liberal for those times, apparently. And the combination killed the show.
That's why they came up with Charlie Wilde, Private Eye. That was the after...
Was that it?
That was the show. See... I can't figure out why. Now you're saying why, so that fills in a void in my research.
Why I didn't do it? You mean
why they changed it from Sam Spade, which was a popular character, to Charlie Wilde?
Who did that?
I don't even know who the actor
Charlie
was.
Charlie Wilde.
It was
Wild
Root.
Primo.
Yeah.
Oh,
you know,
boy.
Charlie.
I wasn't even aware of that. Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
Well, see, they needed the. They probably had the.
No, that was a time of great insecurity for. The networks and the sponsors, anybody who had any kind of a vaguely liberal tinge was verboten.
Did that being in red channels, which was the public...
I'm sure that was the
race.
Yes, in other
areas?
I couldn't get on the air for about 2 years. Uh-huh. And the only way I got back on is I just did all kind of any shows they threw at me. Mm-hmm. That's what my agents said. Look, the only way you're going to get back on is just to keep getting on a sponsored show. And eventually, mm-hmm. of course, they... Since I was really not guilty of anything,
they finally had to go back to the talent, I think.
I wasn't even a good liberal. I was just kind of a half, as we say, liberal.
Well, when did you first get involved with television? Because you had no problem with the...
By the time we got around to... by the time we got around to 57 or so, things had cooled down, so I could work. But there was still nip and tuck that I was going to get on the air for Mr. Adams and Eve, which we did for 2 years.
That was a fine show.
I thought it was a good show. Yeah,
it was good. The Hollywood couple there and all the situations.
I thought it was kind of a bright show and not too sophisticated. But a lot of people thought it was, or some people thought it was too sophisticated.
It's in reruns.
Is it really?
Now around the country
is it?
Here and
no
there
kidding.
They pop in with it.
Well, why ain't I getting a check?
Well, maybe it has it's run
it's
its course.
It was rerun for a while.
Yeah.
Of course, when we shot in those days, it was in black and white.
Yeah.
Everything now is in color, of course. Yeah.
Well, but the usual.
Well, the reruns of Lucy, for heaven's sakes, they're black and white, aren't they?
Well, a lot
but we didn't really make, of course, as many shows as Lucy and Desi did.
Yeah.
We only made
two years
about 62 shows or something like that. in those days we made about 36 a year.
Yeah, yeah.
A season.
Today they're making
about 13 if they get through
they
that.
Can get a
yeah. if they can get through that before being canceled.
Right. Yeah. That's the big difference between that's one of the big differences between radio and television. In the radio days, I know the economics were different, but in the radio days, they would give you a chance.
Oh, yeah.
To do it. On television, you know, if you're not number three or four in the ratings by the fourth program, that's it.
Forget it. Yeah, I think our first year in Sam Spade, we weren't any big smash or anything, you know. Mm-hmm. But they gave it a chance to develop until we finally developed an audience, and then, as far as I know, we were always doing well after that.
Yeah. Oh, it was a good show. It was on.
I thought it was a good show. Yeah.
It was well written. Who wrote that?
Well, all kinds of people.
Oh, they just did a variety, and he had an editor.
Who E. Jack Newman is? He's a producer now. He was one of the early writers. A guy named Gil Dowd.
That's
Johnny Michael Hayes, a well-known writer. Mm-hmm. We had, the best. They were unknown at that time, but they certainly have done well since then. I thought the writing on it was superior most of the time.
I have the feeling that you didn't.
Bill Spear, I must give a great deal of credit to, because he was very good in the story department, and he had definite ideas on how to produce the show. And luckily, we both seemed to agree most of the time, and we got along great.
You probably didn't spend 3 or 4 days rehearsing one of those scripts.
No, far from it. No, we'd get on there, as I remember, about 11:30 on a Sunday morning, and read it around the table, and we'd spend about half an hour, Bill and I, rewriting, cutting, mm-hmm. and then we'd put it on the mic and go to lunch, come back and dress it and put it on the air. Then at one time we had to do two shows, one for the East and one for the West Coast here. And then, of course, when they found out that recording wasn't a dirty name.
Yeah. Well, Bing
Crosby, we could have that. I guess Bing was responsible for that. Yeah. Then we, once we did one show and that was it. You know, they just do the recording for the West Coast.
Yeah.
Poor West Coast.
They always
get
the
second best. Yeah.
There's some wild stories that people have told about the second shows. You know, where they'd break for dinner or something like that, and then invariably one of the important characters on the show
get a
would have
sloshed.
A couple more. Yeah. Martinis than he
Well, that was a terrible
had.
Thing about this, doing two shows. You know, you couldn't you really relax and enjoy yourself, because if you did, you might foul up the show.
Yeah.
And so we did all that after the second show.
Did you? Was Mr. Adams and Eve the first thing that you did on television, or you had done?
Oh, not the first thing, but I mean, it was the first my first series. Yeah.
You move easily from one series to the next. Did two or three of them, haven't you, on TV?
See, I did, after that, what did I do? Oh, I did a show called Dandy that lasted the hot 26 weeks. We had the misfortune of being opposite Andy Griffith, who was the smash of the season.
Was that the show that was based on a couple of Dick Powell?
Dick Powell, yeah. Dick Powell did it on Four Star Playhouse, mm-hmm. kind of a gambler, mm-hmm. but we couldn't do the gambling. Things were very... But he was an ex-gambler who ran a nightclub called Dante's. And I thought it was a pretty good show, but I guess we weren't getting the numbers, so that was it.
See, it started all right.
The next show I did was Felony Squad, mm-hmm. which we got 3 years out of that one.
That's a good... That's a hit. Three years on television? That started in about the middle 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, at that point already, to get 3 years...
Yeah, to get three was all right. I thought it should have gone a little further. I guess people lost interest in it.
Well, they don't give them a chance.
Well, they just... I think, their aspirations weren't the same as mine. I wanted to make a kind of show that Police Story has ended up being. You've seen Police Story, which I think is actually...
Yeah.
That's the kind of show I wanted to have. Nobody else did. So.
Didn't quite. You bounced back to the radio scene for a brief while in the early 70s with the Hollywood Radio Theater Zero Hour thing.
Was only about a couple of years ago, wasn't it?
That's right, about 70. Well, I guess it was 73, maybe 74.
Was it? That was only about. It seems like last year. No, 2 years ago. I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was my old friend Elliot Lewis produced and directed it, and a lot of old friends were on the show, Lorene Tuttle and a lot of people.
Well, that was so good to hear that, because they used mostly prose.
Yeah.
People who really cut their teeth on the radio days. I mean, you could.
I saw some people I hadn't seen in years. You know, I did two shows there, and every show was old home week. You know, and the stories are going back and forth.
Now, aside from the play that's in the immediate future, what else is on the agenda for Howard Duff?
Boy, that's enough, isn't it? 35 to 40 weeks on the road.
You're not looking ahead.
If I survive that, I guess I'll go right back into doing my usual TV and occasional picture.
You're looking forward to doing that kind
of
live thing?
Yeah, because I've never been on a first play before. Mm-hmm. I beg your pardon. I was down in La Jolla Playhouse, which, you know, that isn't a big commercial venture. This is a big commercial venture. That is if it works. That's going to be interesting for me to be right in the beginning of a new project.
A lot of people call the kind of interest that we have in the radio days and the early television thing, they call it trivia.
Yeah.
But it's really it's a nice step backwards to an area of time that provided really good entertainment and a chance for the public to use their imagination. They don't get much of a chance to do that today.
Well, from an actor's standpoint, of course, it was beautiful because you didn't have to worry about lighting and makeup and costuming or anything like that. You just got up there and you created your own costumes and your own imagery through the written word, and as much as you could do it. That was the art of it.
Those were the days.
And we just didn't know how great we had it until it all of a sudden it left.
Well, it was great while it lasted.
But I understand it's coming back a little bit now.
Well, the CBS thing is...
Is that popular? That
that's been renewed.
What do they call that? The
CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
Radio Mystery Theater.
Yeah. And I think that the producer, Hi Brown, comes out here
in the trades here. And he didn't even call me. What do you like that, huh?
Wouldn't it be great
I don't really know him.
It would be fantastic for them to do. Take one night at least.
Okay,
and
that's
have
not a bad
Spade.
Idea. Yeah, we got a lot of the same people still here, you know.
Sure, you
who might like to do it for kicks, you know. We can't really afford them anymore, but they might do it for kicks.
Well, I think it would. I think they have an arrangement with AFTRA to work on a scale, a basic scale. And
yeah,
all
because
that.
I don't think there's that much money in it, you know. As compared to TV.
From what they tell me, they put together one of the hour shows in 2.5 or 3 hours' time, so it's one afternoon.
But it's relatively easy work, so and most people, from a nostalgic standpoint, would, I'm sure, like to do it again. You know.
Well, I think people from a nostalgic
I know Lorene would.
Well, we'd like to hear that sort of thing again. It's kind of nice to have
Why don't you talk to these guys in New York and tell them that we'll do it.
Maybe we can get your...
Speaking unofficially.
Your automobile license number, remember what that was?
137596.
Hey, you win the trivia award of 1975.
You know what? Every once in a while, somebody comes up to me, 137596. What's your license number? 137596. I said that so many times that it's indelibly imprinted someplace.
That's a great way to go. Thank you very much, Howard Duff. It's
thank,
been very
thank you,
nice
Chuck.
Coming out here. Boy, this is great.
It's fun reminiscing down old memory lane again.